The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So for this morning's reflection, I have chosen a topic that we usually don't talk about so much. I like to talk about love. We bandy about suffering a lot. We hear that word a lot in Buddhist centers, suffering. But somehow the word love sometimes seems like a taboo even, because sometimes we might think that, oh, love, ooh, it comes with attachment, bad. We're practicing non-attachment, or even we might misunderstand practicing non-attachment as practicing detachment, which is the wrong understanding. But somehow it seems like love, not sure about love, what's up about this love? And also, another reason is in the West, we're particularly non-devotional practitioners. In the East, if you travel to Burma and other places, you see that, of course, through the cultural conditioning, Buddhism is practiced very devotionally, very heart-centered. And yet, in general, Buddhism is not a guru system. So the teacher is a spiritual friend who's traveled a little further on the path and is just shining a light, but it's not a guru. So that aspect of love and devotion doesn't show up either. I think another reason why perhaps the word love doesn't show up is we practice mindfulness. I think that's a terrible translation of the word vipassana or sati. It's actually overloaded. I can give a whole hour Dharma talk about mindfulness and how inappropriate I think the word has become as a grab-all for a lot of practices. So as a translation of vipassana, actually vipassana is deep seeing how things really are. And I'm going to argue later today, as I build my thesis on love, that actually vipassana is a practice of love, is seeing things as they are, seeing things clearly. And love is seeing things clearly. So, what's love got to do with it? I've heard that somewhere before, right? It's catchy. So, again, I'm an academic, as you might have figured out. So at the beginning of a talk, you're supposed to kind of say what you're going to say, and then you'll say what you're going to say, and then at the end of the talk, you say what you just said. So I'll do the what I'm going to say, like the punchline, and then I'll lay out the thesis. So practice as an act of love. So that's really what I want to be building towards. The fact that we sit and we walk and we pay attention, and sometimes it's grueling, sometimes it's lovely, sometimes it's hard to sit with our minds, to sit with our pain, to sit with our suffering. That's an act of love. Sitting, noticing, paying attention is an act of love. If it wasn't an act of love, suffering would turn us towards, if we didn't hold our suffering with love and didn't with patience and clear seeing, it could potentially turn into nihilism, not caring. Oh, what's the point? There's no care, there's no love to care enough. It could also turn to despair or self-destructive behavior. Or not caring, indifference, which is the opposite of equanimity, which again I'll talk about more in a moment. So what I like to get into now I'm getting to the body of the talk. Academics are laughing. So first, I'd like to talk about different types of love, because this word in English is so overloaded. So maybe that's why we don't so much talk about it here, because there's so many different types of love. So I would like to talk about two different types of love. There is the relational type, and there is the non-relational as a state of being, as suchness, isness, the thing itself. So with relational, then there are three subcategories. The relational love to others, to ourselves, and to experience. Relation to experience. So starting with relational to others, Dr. Helen Fisher at Rutgers, who's done decades of work on love and relational love, romantic love, her work suggests that romantic love, you know, when we hear the word love, usually we think of, oh yeah, romantic love. Romantic love can be broken down into three categories: lust, attraction, and attachment. Familiar with those? Yeah. So, interestingly, lust, if you're also curious about the biological connections, testosterone and estrogen drive lust. No, physical. We're humans. We're human animals. We have estrogen, we have testosterone, hence lust, desire to procreate, continue the species. Okay. Second one, attraction. It suggested that, her research suggests that dopamine and norepinephrine and serotonin support the attraction. And you know that falling in love is like a dopamine hit, and the person sends you an email or a text, or you see them, and it's like it's the same reaction in your brain as if you're taking a hit of cocaine. It really is dopamine. It's the same dopamine reaction. It's like it's a high. It's okay. So, and then attachment, which we think of mature love, familial, oxytocin and vasopressin mediate attachment. So that's kind of a, in terms of relational love, three ways to relate to it. And yet the Greeks broke it down even more, these categories of relational love. So the Greeks recognized eight different types of love. And I found these actually interesting when practicing Buddhism and metta and our own flavor of love, which we don't call love. We call loving kindness. Anyway, I'll get to that. So the first type of love in the Greek, it's eros, erotic love, which is named after the Greek god of love and fertility. You remember the first one, lust, right? Eros, there is a strong connection there. And ancient Greeks considered eros to be dangerous and frightening, as it involves a loss of control through the primal impulse to procreate. You know, they didn't know about progesterone and testosterone. But yeah, I think they knew what eros was about. Eros is passionate, intense form of love that arouses romantic and sexual feelings. So yeah, so now we can kind of see, like, that's the lust. And that's what, in Buddhism, we just call lust. It's physical. It's lust. It's recognizing it, working with it. It's not good. It's not bad. It just is. It's physical, right? Working, recognizing, working with it skillfully. Then the second type of love in Greek is ludus, which is playful love, which is has a little bit of eros in it, but it's more a playful form of love, like the affection between young lovers. Okay, so now this, according to the earlier the Dr. Fisher categories, this is kind of like it has a little bit of lust and a little bit of attraction, right? So it has a little bit of both in there. And as I go through the list, just check into your own experience. You know, yeah, oh yeah, that kind of love. Oh yeah, that's what that type means. Oh yeah, that's what that type is. Like so many different forms of love that you have experienced in your own being, and it all has one title, love, but they're all very different. So see them in your own experience as I speak, please. So playful love. it's a feeling that comes in the early stages of love, fluttering heart, flirting, teasing, feelings of euphoria, right? You hear the dopamine, the euphoria coming in a little bit there. The third type of love is called mania or obsessive love. Yeah. Mania is a type of love that leads a partner into a type of madness or obsessiveness. So that's, as the Greeks thought about of it, they thought it was an imbalance between eros and ludus. So, but in a way, I guess the more modern people think about it, or say if you're a scientist, neuroscientist, or when perhaps the dopamine is pushed too far and there's a sense of addiction to that hit, it really becomes manic, and the various hormones getting out of balance. So these three are in the category of the lust and attraction. And now with the next one, we're going to switch into the next category. The next one is philia, affectionate love. And now we have switched to what Helen Fisher calls attachment, the third category of attachment. You see, I'm drawing parallels between the two different systems. You're with me, right? Yeah, good. Okay. So attachment in Helen Fisher's dichotomy, and in the Greek dichotomy, now number four is philia, affectionate love, which is also translated as friendship. And the ancient Greeks valued philia above eros because it was considered love between equals. So it's love without physical attraction, it's a dispassionate love. Aristotle put it, philia, as dispassionate love, which is free from any sexual attraction. So it's also thought of, I think it's this one that's thought of as brotherly love. It's just friendship. It's just love. Love among equals. Also, it could be thought of as love among friends who've endured hard times together. So that's philia. Familiar with that kind of love? Yeah? Okay. Now, the fifth type is storge, or familiar love. And this is storge primarily has to do with kinship and familiarity. Usually, and this type flows between parents and their children, and children and their parents. And now we get to the sixth type, pragma, enduring love. Love that has aged, matured over time. And this type of love, for example, can show up in married couples that have been together. So it's a friendship that's built over decades. So just wanted to go through these categories in order to kind of like take the word love and maybe disassemble it a little bit. But there's a lot more disassembling to do still. So I want to take a pause before I share the last two categories of the Greek notion, which actually ties more into the universal aspects of love. I want to actually pause and just with the first types of love that I've, the first six types of love that we've discussed, I'd like to share a poem from Daniel Ladinsky, which, by the way, Daniel Ladinsky is known to translate poems from Hafiz, but actually it turns out that he usually dreams them up. So his translations are not they don't really refer to the source material. They're inspired by source material. So with that caveat, this is inspired by Hafiz, written by Daniel Ladinsky. So it goes, and the name of it is With That Moon Language. There it is. Admit something. Everyone you see, you say to them, love me. Of course, you do not do this out loud. Otherwise, someone would call the cops. Still, though, think about this great pull in us to connect. Why not become the one who lives with a full moon in each eye that is always saying, with that sweet moon language, what every other eye in the world is dying to hear. So what I appreciate about what this poem is pointing to is this sense of wanting, this desiring for love, the way that we often change ourselves in order to be loved and get approval. So thinking of this love as a drug, as the different ways that it can affect our behavior. Anthony de Mello, who was both a Jesuit priest and in some ways a Buddhist, I would say, from his teachings, puts it really well in his little book, The Way to Love. Has it ever occurred to you? Actually, it makes two very interesting points. I'll read a couple paragraphs. Has it ever occurred to you that you can only love when you're alone? What does it mean to love? It means to see a person, a thing, a situation as it really is and not as you imagine it to be, and to give it the response it deserves. You cannot love what you do not see. So the first point he's making is love is the same as clear seeing. Is really, really seeing the person, the situation, without your expectations, without your concepts, your categories. He goes on in his words. And what prevents you from seeing? Your concepts, your categories, your prejudices, your projections, your needs and attachments, the labels you have drawn from your conditioning and from your past experiences. Seeing is the most arduous thing a human being can undertake, for it calls for a disciplined, alert mind, whereas most people would much rather lapse into mental laziness than take the trouble to see each person and thing anew with present moment freshness. To drop your conditioning in order to see is arduous enough, but seeing calls for something more painful still, the dropping of the control that society exercises over you, a control whose tentacles have penetrated to the very roots of your being, so that to drop it is to tear yourself apart. If you wish to understand this, think of a little child that is given a taste of drugs. As the drug penetrates the body of the child, it becomes addicted, and its whole being cries out for the drug. To be without the drug is so unbearable a torment that it seems preferable to die. Now, this is exactly what society did to you when you were a child. You are not allowed to enjoy the solid, nutritious food of life, work, play, and company of people, and the pleasures of the senses of the mind. you were given a taste for the drug called approval, appreciation, attention, the drug called success, prestige, power. Having got a taste for these things, you became addicted and began to dread their loss. You felt the criticism of others. So you became cravenly dependent on people and lost your freedom. Others now have the power to make you happy or miserable. And much as you now hate the suffering this involves, you find yourself completely helpless. There is never a minute when, consciously or unconsciously, you are not attuned to the reaction of others marching to the drum of their demands. When you are ignored or disapproved of, you experience a loneliness so unbearable that you crawl back to people to be for the comfort known as support, encouragement, reassurance. To live with people in this state involves never-ending tension, but to live without them brings the agony of loneliness. You have lost your capacity to see them clearly as they are and to respond to them accurately, because mostly your perception of them is clouded by your need to get your drug. Quite profound, the language he uses. Children, drugs, and the way that our dependence on this approval and this love actually helps, makes us perhaps not see people clearly, because we're seeing them now through this projection, this expectation of wanting approval. What do I do? How do I change myself? So you see, it's kind of can be a little bit of a vicious cycle. We don't see them clearly because we want the drug, and we want the drug, we don't see them clearly. So it just kind of like goes on and on. I'll read a little more, another paragraph of his. The consequence of all this is terrifying and inescapable. You have become incapable of loving anyone or anything. If you wish to love, you must learn to see again. And if you wish to see, and if you wish to see, you must give up your drug. How would you ever get there? By ceaseless awareness. That's what we do here. By ceaseless awareness and the infinite patience and compassion that you would have for the drug addict. I love that sentence. There's so much compassion in that sentence. By ceaseless awareness and the infinite patience and compassion that you would have for the drug addict, which is you. It will also help you to undertake activities that you can do with your whole being, activities that you so much love to do, that while you are engaged in them, success or recognition or approval simply do not mean a thing to you. It will help, too, if you return to nature, send the crowds away, and to up into the mountains and silently commute with trees and flowers and animals and birds, sea and sky, clouds and stars. Then you will know that your heart has brought you into the vast desert of solitude. There is no one there by your side, absolute no one. At first it will seem unbearable, but that is only because you are accustomed to aloneness. I like the distinction he's making here. But if you manage to stay there for a while, the desert will suddenly blossom into love. Your heart will burst into song, and it will be springtime forever. And I love the distinction he's making between aloneness and solitude. Aloneness is kind of alone, I'm alone. Whereas solitude is like, solitude, yummy, delicious solitude. So it's interesting to make those distinctions. So, by the way, usually giving talks for me, it's like editing in real time. I often have too much material, so I'm looking at the clock. Okay, so What am I going to say? All right, so I'll move on to the last two types of love, which then will lead us to the other type that I've been building up to the non-relational type of love, suchness. So we're still in relational, but this is the bridge now, bridge between relational and non-relational. So the seventh of the eighth of the Greek types of love is philautia, or self-love, which is different from narcissism. So it's really the self-love is what in Buddhism we describe as metta for oneself, loving kindness for oneself, regard, care, friendliness for yourself, or self-compassion for yourself. So they had the same concept there. And basically the idea is that you need to care for yourself first, love yourself first, have self-regard in order to be available and in order to be able to love others. In fact, filling your own cup first, as Anthony de Mello was referring to in a different way, through solitude, through enjoying what you love in nature, and filling your own cup through care for your own heart, fills your own heart. So you don't need love from others. And then you can see them clearly. You can see them clearly. You can give them love and not necessarily expect it back. If they give it to you, great, lovely. If not, great, lovely. You know, it's because your heart is already full. You're not going around like in the Ludinsky poem, love me, love me, love me, love me, love me. You're telling everyone to love me, love me, love me. Don't you love me? Don't you love me? Like my posts on Facebook, like me. Right? You're not going around doing that because your heart is full. Your heart is nurtured by your own love. It's held. It's completely held in care. The eighth, the last of the loves in the Greek system is agape, or selfless love, agape. And this was the highest and most radical type of love, according to the Greeks. Also often translated as selfless or unconditional love. And this type of love is not sentimental, and it's not condition-based. It's the closest that the system gets to the love, to metta, the loving-kindness in the practice of Buddhism, which I like to call love, because, you know, there's so many words that we use for translating metta, M-E-T-T-A, in Pali, and also related to the word maitri, friendliness. So friendliness, metta, care. But it's not conditional. It just is. It's a sense of love, care, friendliness. That it just is, and it touches yourself, and it touches others. It's not conditional. It's not. In fact, you don't have to like people to love them. That's the interesting kicker. I'll read a paragraph from priest Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams, who's the world's second woman Zen teacher of African descent, and the Library Journal called her the most vocal and most intriguing African American Buddhist in America. So here we go, a couple of paragraphs from her. She says, "You don't have to like anyone at all. People always tease me about this. I hardly like anyone, but I love everyone. And that is possible. In fact, it's the very thing that bridges the spiritual life and the activist life. When I came to Buddhist practice, I thought that when people were at the pinnacle of their practice, they would see the need to respond to the problems. They would see the need to respond to the problems in the world. Isn't that what would happen once you get there, wherever there is? But that wasn't my experience, so I switched my focus to the activists. They were trying to change the world, And I felt that if I could support them with meditation and awareness practices, then they could do it more effectively. What I ran into, of course, was that they pretty much didn't love anyone. So love is what I focused on, because in social justice work, the only option is loving everyone. Otherwise, there is no path to real change. Whether we're leaning towards the spiritual community or the activist community, what we need is the combination of a mind that wants to change the world and a mind that is steady, clear-seeing, and seeks change from a place of love rather than from a place of anger. So loving, even if you don't like. And this was what Dr. Martin Luther King and Gandhi understood and taught. Love. And that is the bridge to the non-relational, the suchness. I'll share one more thing. And this is from the simile of the saw, about how in this practice we aspire, our aspiration to love has nothing to do with liking. So when I ran across the sutta simile of the saw, I found it really, really challenging. It continues to challenge me. And I'll share it with you. May you feel as inspired and challenged in a good way. So the Buddha says, or translated as through the ages, supposedly the Buddha says, practitioners, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handed saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. Actually, let me make it gender neutral. One who gives rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. Wow. That's pretty radical. It continues. Therein, practitioners, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train practitioners. This is challenging, right? Bandits, two-handed saw, they're cutting you limb by limb. No ill will. Loving them. Abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, without ill will. Ah, I love that. I just love that, right? I love that. It's possible. It is possible. There's some stories, but I'll leave them for another. Okay, editing in real time. I'll just say it is possible. Anyway, I'll move on. It's possible in this life, in this very life. So, as we're moving from relational, I spoke about relation to others, relation to ourselves. Now, relation to experience, I want to say just a couple of words about love and relationship to experience. What does it mean to love? I'll share with you, actually, the inspiration for this whole talk came yesterday. I have a chronic illness. I have chronic Lyme, and I have good days and I have bad days. And recently I've had a lot of bad days. And yesterday was a tough day. I was lying and not feeling good and sore throat. And the mind was at peace, but the body was hurting and suffering and just lying down. And this, my mind flipped for a moment, switched into, and this is going to be hard to put into words, but to instead of just being with the experience of the body, to opening up to loving the experience. Just completely resting with love, with, it's like this right now. And it just shifted. Like, still the pain didn't go away, it was still there, the discomfort was there. But there was a shift in loving this experience just as it is. Not liking it, but loving it. The same way earlier I was talking about loving is not liking, but resting in love, just like it's not fighting reality, but even going one step beyond not fighting it. It's just completely opening into resting, into complete acceptance and love of this moment's experience just as it is. So that was the inspiration for this talk. And Byron Katie has an interesting quote. She says, "I am a lover of what is, not because I'm a spiritual person, but because it hurts when I argue with reality." And she often teaches with the quote, "Loving what is, loving what is, loving what is." So what does it mean? What does it mean to have your awareness imbued with love? What does it mean? Paying attention. Loving awareness. Not, what does it mean to love your suffering, love your pain? Not liking it, but just resting into love with every cell of your body. So that gets us to the non-relational now. Now we've crossed the bridge. The way you do that is both practically and also it's recognizing that love is not so much something that you do or invoke, but it's the state of being. It's the suchness of how things are, of consciousness, of being, of the fabric of this existence. Stephen Levine, the author of many books, one of them being Healing into Life and Death, puts it this way: love is our true nature, our birthright. To go beyond conditions and conditioning is to experience our pure, uncramped, undistorted awareness. Pure mind and pure heart are one, undifferentiated being. The ever connected, the deathless. And by the way, the deathless is the word that's a translation of Nibbana, which is liberation, freedom, awakening. So love is a way to freedom, or actually recognizing love is recognizing freedom. Another way this has been put beautifully is by Anita Morjani, who wrote this very interesting book, Dying to Be Me, My Journey from Cancer to Near Death and True Healing. And she had a very profound near-death experience where she was clinically dead for a while in the hospital and had many interesting... And when she came back, by the way, her stage 4 metastasized cancer was cured within a couple of weeks, which is unheard of clinically. So something happened there when she was dead. And she reports, in my near-death experience, NDE state, when she was in the other realm, as she talks about it anyway. But I'll share this with a don't-know mind, not reifying, but just sharing what she says, take it, leave it, no attachment. In my NDE state, I realize the entire universe is composed of unconditional love, and I am an expression of this. Every atom, molecule, quark, and tetraquark is made of love. I can be nothing else because this is my essence and the nature of the entire universe. Even things that seem negative are all part of the infinite, unconditional spectrum of love. And then I was overwhelmed by the realization that God isn't a being, but a state of being. And I was now that state of being. So state of being, the suchness of what is this human experience, just being consciousness. I mean, isn't it amazing that anything even exists? Like that you're alive? That somehow the Big Bang led to this? Like that we even exist and are conscious, and there's like sometimes my mind just kind of blows open, like, wow, it's amazing that there's even anything. So there is this, and holding this all with a don't know mind, because we go through our lives through with like a lens, like a really contracted lens, like I need to do this, need to do that, need to do this. Our biological imperative really closes us. What if the doors were thrown completely open and the blinds were completely thrown apart and you could see that your being, your complete being, your consciousness, your existence, it's all interconnected and it's all love. And in Buddhism, there is something called liberation through the beautiful. We often don't talk about it and we don't teach it. Liberation through the beautiful. It's freedom through love. A relational love is a step towards absolute, unconditional love as a state of suchness. And with that, I'll share one last thing. When you rest into the expansive nature, the ease of love, pain is let go of. It transforms from your pain to the pain. Your relationship to everything changes, and that is freedom. Freedom through love. May we all be free through love.